Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. There are books that I will recommend, inshallah, simple books, and there are many free books that are available as well. Unfortunately, we didn't have the time to. We generally get these from Maulana Salim Dorat in Leicester. We get this set of three kitabs. Some of you may already have them on. We can tell you where to get them. Also, remember that whatever you learn here, and I'm telling you from personal experience, after having myself studied these issues intricately in detail, right? Generally, even beyond the level that most people will study them as a mufti. When I actually got there the first time, everything went out of my head. Because it's just very difficult to put theory into practice until you actually get there. So what I'm going to suggest, and I will, it's something I suggest every year, this is to prepare us in general, take down points that you think are relevant to you, and of course you're free to make lots of notes if you want to. But any basic Hajj book will provide you most of the juridical content, except some of the unique kind of things that don't come up all the time or that are not answered. But the best way to do this, and this is what I do all the time, is that the day before, I will re-study and familiarize myself and get really to grips with what's going to happen the next day. So if tomorrow is Arafah day, I'm going to read all the laws of Arafah again today. Don't depend on what you hear here only. Unless, mashallah, you have photographic memories and you can just remember word to word and you can just bring it back up. Most people can't. So you're going to have to do this again. This is only a preparation. Don't consider this to be the final. And then, for example, then the next day is Muzdalifah. So you will prepare for Arafah and Muzdalifah. The next day is Mina. You prepare how you do the stoning. You'll read that again. Have a few people that you go with that you can revise this with. That's the best. So take these books with you when you go, and have your group or your family, if you're going with your family, husband and wife, children maybe, sit down, or with your parents or whoever it is, sit down every day and just try to go over what's going on the next day. That is very, very useful, inshallah. So as you can see, this entire presentation is supposed to be a practical and a visual guide. I mean, as visual as we can make it. It could be obviously way more visual, but the main thing is the theory and then the practical aspects of it. Hajj in the Quran. وَأَذِّنْ فِي النَّاسِ بِالْحَجِّ يَأْتُوكَ رِجَالًا وَعَلَىٰ كُلِّ ضَامِرٍ يَأْتِينَ مِنْ كُلِّ فَجٍ عَمِيقٍ. This is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala told Ibrahim alayhi salam to proclaim. And inshallah, this is what we're responding to. That word inshallah has reached us. And this is what we're trying to respond to. الْحَجُّ أَشْهُرٌ مَعْلُومَاتٍ. The Hajj is of these known prescribed months. فَمَنْ فَرَضَ فِيهِنَّ الْحَجَّ. And whoever Hajj becomes obligatory on during these months, then they should avoid the following. فَلَا رَفَثَ وَلَا فُسُوقَ وَلَا جِدَالَ فِي الْحَجِّ. Indecent speech, misbehavior, or quarreling for anyone undertaking the pilgrimage. And general guidance here, whatever good you do, Allah is well aware of it. So this is to show that you're going for Hajj. Hajj is a real challenge for a lot of people because that gives them a step up. It gives them an additional title. There are many people who are not a doctor or a... People like to have titles on their name. So somebody's not a doctor, Mawlana, Mufti, or whatever. There'll be a Haji. Haji so and so. It's a big deal. And for a lot of people to have gone for Hajj is a big deal. One is it's a big deal because it's a major accomplishment from a spiritual perspective, which is good, which is fine. But then the other one, unfortunately, some people use it to show off. I've done 10 Hajj. I've done this, I've done that. So this is to say, look, whatever good you do, Allah knows it. You don't need to show off. You don't need to tell anybody. You don't need to make a big deal out of it. It's completely permissible to tell people you've done your Hajj. Because all you're doing is you're telling them that I fulfill my obligation. It's one of the main pillars of Islam. So you have to, you don't hide it. But you don't show off about it. It's for Allah. So sincerity is being encouraged right from the beginning. Provide well for yourself. Make sure you take your everything you need for your journey. But then, just so we don't become so infatuated with exactly what to take, and you know, we're taking like our whole kitchen, our whole bedroom or whatever, it says the best provision is the taqwa of Allah, is being mindful of Allah. Don't forget that as your main thing you pack with yourself. You're going to pack all your creams and everything else, but make sure you pack with you taqwa, because that's really what's going to make it worthwhile for you in terms of the hereafter. Always be mindful of me, you who have understanding. And that's what we want to be. We want to be people of ulul albab, people of understanding. Right, now jumping right into the practical aspects. These are things that I would say are, some of these are essential, and other things are quite essential. Out of these, the most essential thing for men though, and only for men, is this. Without that, you don't have to buy it from here. I know Azhar Academy is down the road from here, but you don't have to buy them here if you're going to Medina Munawwara first. Okay. Right, so you don't have to take it from here if you don't want to, especially if you've got weight restrictions. Medina Munawwara, you can buy them in every store there needy. And if you're going from here direct to Makkah, then make sure you have, because you'll have to put your ihram on and intend before you actually get to Jeddah. So you want to make sure you're not caught without it, otherwise it'd be the first contravention there. Travel belts, they come in different sizes. You can have the really thin ones, and you can have the ones in which you can put a bit more stuff. I would definitely suggest that you take either a larger belt that you can put things in, like your phone. I know I'm saying phone, that you shouldn't, but if you're going with someone, then carry your phone with you, and you'll buy a local SIM. Otherwise, it's so easy to get lost down there, and you want to make sure you've got a connection with the people that are with you. So that's a necessity in that sense. You'll need your small dua books. People carry small dua books. Maybe they'll carry a few other little documents and things. You need somewhere to carry them. So you can either have a shoulder bag, or you can have it in a belt, whatever you feel comfortable. These belts, they call them waist packs as well. You can have them. The other purpose of this is to keep the ihram up. What does that mean? So we're not used to wearing lungis, sarongs, these sheets. The belts help to keep them up. But inshallah, we'll do a demonstration of the ihram. Believe me, there's one or two special ways of doing it, and somebody can pull it and it still won't come off. And it'll stay on for 4 days, 5 days without a problem. And then you've got the belt on top anyway. So the belt is very useful. Safety pins, for some people they're good to keep the top sheet together as well if you want to, and for some people they want to keep the bottom sheets together. But there's a way to tie the bottom sheets in a way that nothing's going to happen. But the top sheet, sometimes you might want it. This is not essential, this is just if you want to. Most of this is still for men, this for women. But this, right, sandals. You have to take some sandals. I'll talk about them in a bit more detail, because you're going to be doing a lot of walking. So you need to make sure you have sandals that qualify, number one. And not just any sandals that qualify, but sandals that are comfortable as well, so that you're not then worrying about blisters and a messed up foot, because then that gets really difficult. Right, these two things now. Why do you need this? Many people will need this because when you're walking a lot in the heat and sweating, between your thighs, it will get very sore. They'll get, is it called shaft? Or chaft? Anti-chafing, right? So you need this. You can either use Vaseline, but Vaseline gets, this is the more professional stuff, this lanacane. I checked around for lanacane, they seem to be out of stock in most places in this country, right? But that's one of the best. There's another one called Body Glide, and there's a few other anti-chafing creams, gels and solutions. So go to a chemist and buy something that will really help you. Of course, if you're very thin and you don't ever have that problem, then it's different. But for a lot of people, this is a massive issue, because once you get sore there, then walking gets really difficult. What this does, the thing about lanolin is that it's fragrance free, and it dries it doesn't leave a residue like Vaseline does. But if you can't find anything, then Vaseline will have to do. By the way, you can buy these kind of things in Makkah Mukarrama, Medina Munawwara. I forget the name, but they make one which I bought last year. It's made from beeswax. It's a yellow package. I forget the name of it, but it's quite expensive, like £8-9 from what I remember for one tube of that stuff. So if you can get something here from Boots or whatever, then you'd rather do that. There's lots of other ones you can buy from the stores here. Right, footwear. This is one massive mistake that people make, and then they're struggling down there. They've spent lots of money in buying comfortable footwear here. They go there and they find out that this is not valid footwear. You have to have valid and comfortable footwear. So now we're going to discuss all of these. This is a man only problem. Women don't have to worry. They can wear socks, they can wear comfortable shoes. Of course, they're not going to wear heels there, just wear comfortable shoes. And not those, women should not wear those ballet shoes. You know, those that have just like a thin layer at the bottom. Wear something with some, with a good grip, and also that's spongy, that has a good sole, because you're going to do a lot of walking. Right. So for men though, in the Hanafi school, they have a restriction. The restriction, I think in all madhabs, the restriction is that you can't cover your ankles, whether you're Hanafi or Shafi'i or whatever madhab you are. But the Hanafis at least have an additional restriction, which is not in the Shafi'i school, but it is in the Hanafi school. I'm not sure about Malikis and Hanbalis, but in the Hanafi school, the additional restriction is the metatarsal cannot be covered either. And that means, you know the part you, this part here, the part you, where the shoelaces are, that has to be uncovered. So now, what you're restricted to is, let's discuss that. Do you think these are permissible? No. The reason is that particular one, these may be, but not those. The problem with these ones is that this strap is too much on the surface of the foot. It's not above the surface, it's not on the leg part. Right? If this is the foot here, this strap here is generally up here. So that's covering. Any part of the top of the foot that the way it meets the leg, or the shin, that can't be covered. So generally these type are not going to be acceptable in the Hanafi school. Unless of course you cut this off. These ones, it depends on your foot shape. Right? These black ones, some people get away with this, I couldn't. So last year, somebody took pictures and sent it to me, and he was fine, because this part here, the top strap, for him, it was on his shin part, on his leg, and not on the metatarsal. So he was clear. Whereas for me, it was more on my upper part of the foot than it was on there, so I couldn't use them. So you go to, you can get those, what's the company? You can go to Sports Direct, about, I don't know, 15, 20 pounds. But they're very comfortable if they work for you. If they don't work for you, then find something else. There's other companies that make those, but make sure that that uppermost strap is going to be not on the top of your foot. Right. Then the slipper in the middle, this brown cream one, that's clearly not permissible. That's the most common one. They sell them all over there as well. Shafi'is are allowed, Hanafis aren't allowed that one. Right? Or anything representing that, because that covers the shoelace area. In terms of what always works are flip-flops. The good traditional flip-flop. That is what works. That shape, that style. But don't take those normal 1 or 2 pound flip-flops. Because what's going to happen is the part that goes between your toes, that will irritate your toes and you'll blister that area. because it's made of, I don't know what material it's made of. So don't get the cheap ones. And the sole is very thin, so you're going to wear through it, and it's going to be very uncomfortable when you have to walk miles and miles in it. And number three, everybody has those. So somebody's going to pick yours up unless you've got size 12 or 13, like I do. Right? So these are the Croc flip-flops. A friend of mine used them last year. They're about 16, 17 pounds they were in Sports Direct, or a bit more, 25 pounds maybe. But it's worth spending because they're very comfortable and they fulfill the criteria. These blue ones, they're very good. Or you can get the other ones that have a thicker sole and they've got more of a cloth straps that are not rubber, they're cloth. They work generally better. They have a thin strip of cloth in between the toes. And they're thick because you need a lot of that cushioning. And these ones at the bottom, they're something that I've been looking at for the last 2-3 years. They're not a new contraption, but probably for Hajj they're a new contraption. They fulfill all the criteria because these black ones at the bottom, these black and yellow Vibrams. It's a special company. They used to cost 70, 80, 90 pounds. So last year they were very prohibitive, so I didn't pick a pair up. But this year, for some reason, they were on sale. So I managed to pick some up for about 25 pounds. But they're still available for about 34 pounds or something like that. Or 28 pounds or 30 pounds something. Now, you'll have to get used to those. And from some of the discussions I've had online, some people who've used them, they said that if you're not used to walking in them, it will get difficult if you're just trying to do it there. Right? If you're not used to walking for 2-3 weeks beforehand, then it may be too adventurous for you to try to use them there straight away. I'm taking a pair with me, inshallah, and I'm going to see what happens. It seems it's too natural to walk in because your toes are all independent. So you're either used to it or not. It has a decent sole though. But you can't go wrong with these flip-flops. Your traditional, nice, comfortable flip-flop, that's what you need. Everybody is clear about the footwear. And of course, if you have any questions, you can ask later. Now these are sleeping items. They will mainly be useful one night only for several hours, which is the Muzdalifah night. Now, this is a bit maybe pushing it, but sometimes it's very useful, especially for those who are going with husband and wife and they want some more privacy and you want to carry it. Remember, you're going to be carrying this. So it's a trade-off between comfort and how many things you want to take and what you can carry. So if you're a real good backpacker and you really understand these things and you want to take a tent, you can do that. Most people don't. It's so dark there, don't worry about it. Generally the women will all sleep together in one area and the guys will sleep together in another area. It's not generally a problem. Camping foam mat, again, that's an additional luxury which you don't really need. It's all in Muzdalifah where you're going to need this. In Mina most groups will give you sponge and some kind of mattress. Some give you thin ones, some give you thick ones. It depends on what your group promises and what you pay for. That's what it is about. But a lot of groups, they don't. They expect you to take your own sleeping material, even in Mina. So in Mina is where this is. In Mina, generally most groups will provide you some form of bedding, but ask them and make sure you know what they're providing. And if they're not, and they expect you to take your own, then it's up to you to take what you want. But it's easier to take to Mina because you'll generally go there in a coach, and you can just put it there for 3-4 days. But in Muzdalifah, you don't want to be carrying too many things around with you. In Muzdalifah, the only thing you want to carry is a small sleeping bag. When I say small, it's going to be hot there. It's summer, so you don't need those that go down to 15 degrees or, you know, minus. They will be too hot anyway. All you need is a thin one, and the secret is to get the one that can roll up the smallest that it can, right? And a small travel pillow. And it doesn't have to be this size. This is probably the wrong travel pillow to take there, because when you're sleeping on the floor, you don't want a curved travel pillow. In fact, these are probably not, in the plane they say these are not very good anymore anyway. Because generally in the plane as well, the headrest is protruding, and then this makes you sit a bit further out. So these are kind of unintuitional, they're not very good. Inflatable camping pillow, that's probably a good idea. Or you can get these other ones that you can just roll up into very small, and it depends on how much you want. Then you can also use some other part of your bag and then with a small thin pillow on top. There's many things that you can do. But for Muzdalifah, all you need to really take is a small sleeping bag, an inflatable pillow, and sometimes they're selling those reed mats or those plastic mats for a few riyals. So you could get one of those if you wanted to. Otherwise, it's generally fine. Most people will take a sleeping bag there, a cheap one, £10 or something, and then just leave it there. Because you don't want to then carry it on from there. A lot of people do that. In fact, the Hajj group that I go with, they actually give you a nice, backpack with a small sleeping bag that they've tested over the years, and a pillow, and then they expect you to just leave it there. You'll get another one next year if you go. Right? Just leave this there and carry on if you need to. These are other useful items, and I'll tell you what I found to be useful, and others may be a bit of an overkill again. The most important thing that I think you need there is this. Whether you're in Medina Munawwara or Makkah, remember you're going into these huge masjids, and your slippers, if you put them in the racks just like that, they're probably going to go missing. Not because people want to steal them. People just assume that it's their slippers. Because how many unique slipper types can you find in the world? There are 2 million, 3 million people there. Alright? So, men and women, they should buy these drawstring bags. You can buy them for 2, 3, 4 pounds from Sports Direct. And sometimes you get them free, the PE packs or whatever you call. The reason they're so good is because when you don't need them, you just fold them up, put in your pocket. When you need them, you pull them out, put your slippers in there, put them on your back and go into the masjid. So you can literally keep your slippers with you. That's the best thing to do, because what happens in Medina Munawwara in the masjid, you put your slippers somewhere, and although the slipper shoe racks are marked, it's very difficult to keep remembering each time the number and where and so on. And in Makkah you have to move around, keep them with you. The other benefit is that if you want to keep a bottle of Zamzam with you to fill there and a few other essentials, you can keep them. But just make sure that you take a nicer one. If you take the most flimsy one, eventually it'll break from here. Then you're going to have to tie it up and all this. So try to find a good reinforced one that's not too heavy. You don't want to make it a backpack at the same time, because you want to be able to then fold it up and put it in your pocket when you don't need it. That I would say is the most important thing. The second thing which I think is very important is this, especially if you find it difficult to sleep with the light on. A lot of people have this problem. So that helps a lot when you want to sleep both on your journey and there in Mina, and people have got the light on, you want to take sleep. That's very useful. If you're traveling on Emirates, they give out these really nice ones on Emirates, probably as good as what you can buy. So it depends on the flight. Not every flight offers these eye masks, but some do. Drawstring bag. Now, it doesn't have to be a drawstring bag. It could be one of those plastic money bags. It could be, I've seen people use an empty water bottle, a small one, and put their pebbles in there, which is actually a good, very good sizing factor. Right? If your pebble goes in, you know it's the right size. So I know a number of people who didn't have any bags, so they use that. So, but this is just all things. Earplugs, if you've got a problem with people snoring, you're going to be most likely literally next to people on both your sides. There is not an inch of space in most of these camps, unless you're in some very luxurious camp that you've paid huge amounts for. In Mina, it doesn't matter. You've got a 5-star hotel, but your camp in Mina most likely is going to be the same. Unless you've paid for the VIP camps, which are like proper structures right next to the Shaitan Jamarat. The Europeans and the Americans, our camps are 50 to 60 minute walk away from the Jamarat, so we'll be doing a lot of walking. But you will be literally next to each other. And don't go there and try to take over two mattresses, one on top of the other. That happened last year. There was this particular individual who said, I want two mattresses. Man, one is enough. What's wrong with you? It's paid for, one for each person. And there was another person who was, mashallah, I think he or she, I can't remember who it was, said that, no, I need to take 1.5 people's space. But you can't do these things there unless you pay for two, because it's all marked out. There's a lot of people, and not everybody, although the majority do get to stay in Mina, some people actually have to go in the overflow areas which are just outside of Mina. So earplugs help for people who are very sensitive, because they provide this white sound. MP3 prayer, now it's on your phone or whatever, it's good to listen to inspirational lectures, especially if you're not going with a group that has an inspirational speaker. One of the best things that you can have about a group after their organization and being very well managed is that you've got a scholar on site that gives inspirational lectures and is there to answer your questions. There's nothing worse than being in the best group but not having access to a scholar, and you just think you've done something wrong or you don't know how to deal with it. And that's really difficult for women, because they have this one issue, the menstruation issue, which really, really causes a lot of confusion. So when you choose a group, which may be too late now, choose a group with an inspirational speaker, because he can just turn your, improve your Hajj tremendously to keep you going. Otherwise, you do things yourself. And remember, it's not just ritual, it's about getting in the frame of mind. And that really helps if you've got somebody like that. As soon as you get there, they'll most likely give you face masks. They did to us. As soon as we got out in Medina Munawwara from the flight, they gave us face masks. You can wear them, people wear them for sanitary, hygienic reasons, because there's so many people and you just want to avoid catching something, right? But you can't wear them during ihram. Men or women can't wear them during ihram, because they touch your face, they cover your face. So you will see people doing it, but that doesn't mean we can do that. It's not permissible. But out of ihram you can do that. This colored packing tape, I inherited this from another presentation, but it's useful sometimes for marking your bag out, because your bags are going to be constantly moved, Makkah, Medina, etc., etc., and you're not going to necessarily carry them. They'll get people to carry them for you. So if you've got a generic bag that looks like that anybody else's, it's a good idea to mark it with some cloth or something, so you can say, hey, that's my bag, right? Alarm clock or use phone if you need to have a little nap somewhere or whatever the reason is. The other thing that's very useful are these, the spees, tawaf counters. You can get the manual beaded ones, or you can use that. Another way to do this, if you want to count your tawaf, because a lot of people get confused, have I done 3 circuits or 4? And some people really have a massive problem with this sometimes. What I found to be useful, if you've got nothing else to count on, get your phone comes back, you've done 1 circuit, press 1. Second circuit, press 2. So then, but even in that, you could still get messed up, because you might have forgotten once, and then you're suddenly halfway around and say, did I press it or not? So you just have to focus. And a flashlight, phones do that as well today. Of course, take your charger with you. There is electricity in the tents down there that you can charge your phone with. What I would also suggest, a multi-plug extension. Because what's going to happen is there's going to be one in the tent. There's going to be some sockets here and some there, some there. But everybody's going to want to use them. So how does everybody do that? So the best bet is, why don't you just take like this basic 4-plug extension with a short extension. They're very light anyway. So you put it up there and other people will use it as well. And thus you get their reward for doing that. And that's very useful. Okay. Phones. You can read that for yourself. You don't want to do roaming unless you've got a special plan that allows you to special roaming in Saudi Arabia. You buy local SIMs down there. So there's, unfortunately from last year, they made it more complicated. You can't go and just pick up a SIM like you can in this country. In fact, now this is, in England, it's probably one of the only countries, one of the few countries that allow you to pick up a SIM phone, a SIM card anonymously. Right? Most other countries, you have to register. So basically you'd have to go in and register, and then they give you an ID, and you have to keep that ID, because every time you go to top up your phone, you'll need that ID, otherwise they won't top it up. So it's a bit more difficult. But there's all of these companies, Mobily and Zain and Saudi Telecom, etc. Wi-Fi may be available in your hotels, obviously. Now for women, when you go into Masjid al-Nabawi for your ziyarat of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the women there will be checking everybody's bags, and they will take out and not allow any phones with cameras. Very strict about that, unless you know somebody gets it in somehow, right? So for women, to make it easy for you, when you go into the Masjid and you don't need to take your phone, then don't take your phone. But if you have to take your phone, then take a phone that doesn't have a very obvious camera or a camera on it, which is very difficult nowadays. A basic phone. What a lot of people do is they keep their UK phone and take another basic phone to use around there. That's another option that you can do. Because you can't leave it outside. You're going to have to take it with you or leave it in your hotel. And of course, make sure your phone is unlocked. A lot of people, they take their phone there and then it's locked to three or to... So make sure your phone is unlocked from here. You have to pay sometimes 15, 20 pounds to get it unlocked. Check on eBay, sometimes it's cheaper there. Right, to get an unlock code or something, but take an unlocked GSM phone, otherwise it's not going to work there. Spiritual preparation. We've dealt with some of these things, but just to refresh ourselves, sincerity, why you're going for Hajj, very important. Repentance from all past sins. Don't wait to do that there, do it from here. So when you go there, you can start benefiting more from it. If you go there purified, you'll receive more of the embellishment than if you go there first and work on shedding the sins first. So start from now. The journey, your journey has already started. We live in weird times. In the previous times, it used to take them 6 months to a year to a few years to get to Hajj. They would work their way there. They wouldn't even have enough money. They would actually work somewhere, stay there for a few months, then carry on. But in that whole journey, every step would increase them. Imagine that psychological feeling of close, being that much closer. We get there in a few hours. And sometimes before that we're so busy that we're not even in the mood. We've made our prayer, we've paid for our tickets and packages, but we're so busy, we do our packaging, but we've never had time for the spiritual preparation. So get into the mode from now. As I said, start doing your dhikr from now. Start doing your istighfar from now and start getting an idea of what you want from Allah. Debts. A lot of people ask, can I go for Hajj if I have debts? The simple answer to that is, if you've got a debt that is not immediately payable, in which you wouldn't be considered to be oppressing your creditor, and it's you repay over 3 years or 5 years, then you can go for Hajj, as long as it's not going to delay in your repayment. So you can go for Hajj and continue to pay off your debts, it's fine. If you owe someone money and you're not giving it to them and you want to go for Hajj, that's problematic. You'll have a Hajj, but you'd be sinful for delaying of the debt. So that will impact on your reward of your Hajj. But if they don't mind and they let you go, it's fine. Write your will. That's a general suggestion, just in case you don't come back. Nowadays, journeys are much safer, but traditionally people always wrote their wills because you don't know what was going to happen. There were a lot of highway attacks and there was a lot of stuff because Hajj caravans were very lucrative. People had a lot of things they were taking, so they would be attacked traditionally. In fact, from Baghdad in the Abbasid Caliphate, they used to prepare for 6 months for the Hajj. Preparation, and then the army would go with this large caravan, but that must have been amazing. You know, can you imagine several thousand people or 100,000 people going for Hajj on camels and horses and caravans and stopping over? That was must have been an adventure. It's totally different. Our Hajj is totally different now. Learn as much as possible about Hajj and Umrah. Fiqh and methods, meaning, spiritual aspects and historical aspects. Be more informed. The worst thing you can do is to go to any country and then start looking around, what am I supposed to do? There's sometimes I've had to take a trip where I haven't researched the area and you're just like fish out of water. But when you know what's there, what you're supposed to do, what you should be seeing, where you should be going, what you should be doing, inshallah, this is one of the first steps towards that. Start memorizing du'as that you can read when you're doing tawaf and in different places. Start memorizing those du'as from now. So you're less restricted there of always having to pull out a kitab or a book with your sweaty hands. Because it gets a bit uncomfortable doing these things. And don't just rely on keeping du'as on your phone. Because your phone might die and you're left, you know, with nothing. Learn how to pray during a flight. How do you do that? I would suggest, I'll go over it basically, but for more detail, look on zamzamacademy.com. There's a whole video showing of the procedure of praying and what time to pray, how to observe times. The crux of it all is this. If you can pray standing, because it's not food serving time and is placed in the galleys on the larger flights, then pray standing on a blanket facing in the right direction Generally, you can tell that from the in-flight maps that they give you. Very easy to find out. Otherwise, ask somebody for help. Mostly, the non-Muslim airlines are much better about this than some Muslim airlines. Although I found Ittihad was very good. They actually have a curtain now in the doorway galleries. Most airlines don't have curtains there, shutting off the doorway area, if you notice. But Ittihad do, and they have these pre-packed musallas, jaya namaz as you call them, and they shut the area off and they make that as a prayer. Once I was on Kuwait Airlines and I said, can I pray? And the guy gave me a fatwa. He said, it's allowed to pray sitting down, pray sitting down. So they tend to be a bit more aggressive with you than, for example, United Airlines, where she sorted me out, then she came and woke me up for the next prayer because I told her what time my next prayer was, and she stood there making sure nobody went past. But you don't want to push it too much. There's a lot of people there. On a Hajj flight, there are generally going to be a lot of Muslims there. So try to not let it be too much. Now, if it's food time and you can't get out, then pray in your seat. And then you can pray in any direction you want, but you have to then just repeat it. Because when you're forced to miss an obligatory element of the salat, which is standing and facing the qibla, then you have to repeat it afterwards. If you're forced to, if you're prevented from it because of being because of there being no space or whatever, so just sit in your and then pray and then redo it afterwards. Time wise, you just look at what's outside. Is it sunset? It's Maghrib time. Don't go with London times or Saudi times while you're flying there. And it also depends on how your flight is going to be, which way you're going. If you have any particular questions about that, let me know afterwards. Physical, mental preparation. Start walking lots from now, if you're not very fit to start with. Mental preparation, get into it. Understand. The whole point of this course is to wake us up in that regard. And the biggest thing is patience. You're going to need a lot of it. Now, we're going to see a lot of weird people there. I remember once I said to a friend of mine, who was a very wise man, I said to him, man, that person is very weird. He says, you know what, you're probably weird as well. I said, what do you mean by that? He says, everybody's weird in relationship to somebody else. If we act differently to somebody else, then we're weird as well. So everybody's weird in that sense. But that's just how people are. So don't get fazed too much about that. You'll find there's some aggressive people there. You'll see arguments in Mina over space and place and water and the toilet line. Sometimes you wait for an hour for the toilets, especially in Muzdalifah. I'll tell you when I get there. You just need a lot of it. Just take it as it comes. That's the best thing. I remember the first time I went for Hajj, much younger, five young guys we went with, and we were trying to do everything first, get onto the first coaches, and just trying to do everything as though it's some kind of assault course. Right? And then the next time I said, you know what, that's the wrong way to do Hajj. Yes, mashallah, you know, you went first there and you get there and this, that and the other and I accomplished it. It's not the point. You're not expected to do that. Just take it easy. Just relax. Allah knows your intentions. Just take it as it comes. Don't get left behind though. But just take it as it comes and as your opportunity comes, go for it. Right, this is just to give you an idea that when you get to Makkah, where will you be located? Now, this is a very old picture. Most likely, I'll tell you where you'll be located. Most likely, you'll either be, if you're in the big towers, they are here. The Abraj al-Bayt, that massive complex and structure with the clock tower. There's a lot of hotels in there. You might be in there. This is the Hilton. This is the Dar al-Tawheed Intercontinental. And most, if you're not in those three places, you're most likely going to be in this area. Because that area still survives. In fact, that's the only area that survives. All of this area, all the hotels here have gone. All of this area has gone. In fact, there's work going on to expand here, which you'll see in the other. But all of this is gone. This was the best place to stay before. Because you'd come out of your hotel and the gate was right there. It was one of the best places to stay. That's where the traditional Makkah hotel was. And Bab al-Umrah is here. But all of that is gone. This went a while back, Jabal Umar, that's called behind there. Now there's new complex of hotels coming up here. And some of them are ready. You may be in one of those, I'm not sure. Otherwise, you're going to be totally out of this area, like I am, in Aziziyah, which is close to Mina. We have a non-shifting package where you're going to be in Aziziyah right from the beginning, and you're going to have that through your Hajj. A lot of people, what you'll have is, you'll have a hotel here somewhere, but then a day or two before Hajj, they'll take you to Aziziyah or Quday or somewhere like that. And then all your stuff will be there as well. And then you'll go to Mina, you'll do your Hajj, you'll come back, and then you'll go directly to Jeddah. But anyway, that's just basic. This is now an internal. All of this is gone. This is a lot of this is expanded. But let's just assume that we're still... just the general idea of what this is all about. As you can see, that's the door of the Kaaba there. And these are the big clock tower buildings, and that's the Hilton. And most people will be in this direction. That's Ajyad. That's where the hotels still survive. Safa is in that direction. Where do you start your Hajj from? Sorry, your Tawaf. Your Tawaf starts from here. That's the one closest to the door. Alright? The one closest to the door. That's where your Tawaf will begin, and you will go round like this. And that's the Maqam Ibrahim is here. Maqam Ibrahim. You can't see it in this, but and this is the semicircular. In Hajj, there's hardly going to be a place like this. This is, mashallah, quite a lot of space. Right now, there's other pictures. They've actually made these structures, these temporary structures within here that I'll show you in another picture. Now, to start understanding the jurisprudence of Hajj. What's very important to understand are the months of Hajj. There's a concept called the months of Hajj. The months of Hajj are specifically Shawwal, Dhul-Qa'dah, and 10 days of the Hijjah. Shawwal means the month after Ramadan. So as soon as Eid comes, you've started the months of Hajj. What it means by the months of Hajj, technically speaking, is that if you've got about, I mean, what's the basic package this year? 3,500 approximately? 3,500. So if you've got £3,500 in the months of Hajj, then it becomes an obligation on you. As soon as the months of Hajj go by, there's no obligation because there's no Hajj is finished. But every year, if you've been missing Hajj, every year you've been sinful for delaying it. But you only look at whether it's obligatory or not during the months of Hajj. And that is during Shawwal, if you've got enough money. If you had lots of money in Ramadan, but you spent it or it's gone now, and then the months of Hajj come, Hajj is not obligatory on you anymore. Anyway, that's just a side point which is not going to bother us because we've decided and we're in the months of Hajj right now. What is more important though is how it determines the Hajj type. There are three types of Hajj, as you can see here. Now consider this grey area to be the month of Hajj. Shawwal starts here. Right? Shawwal starts here at this point. And this is the 10th of Dhul-Hijjah. That's the 10th of Dhul-Hijjah, that line. So in these 2 months and 10 days, are you going to be doing an Umrah or not? If you are going to be doing an Umrah, then your Hajj cannot be this Hajj, which is called Ifrad. It's going to be one of these two Hajjs. Now, if you're doing Umrah, and you're doing it as most people will be doing, which is, I'm going to go there and do a Umrah, then I'm going to come out of my Ihram, and I'm going to be out of Ihram until the 8th of Dhul-Hijjah, and then I'm going to put another Ihram on for Hajj, then you are doing this Hajj. For the more brave, they will do this Hajj. It has the most reward, which is that as soon as you go to Makkah, and you can only do this if you're not going to go to Medina, Munawwara, in between. How many of you are going to Makkah first, then Medina, then Hajj? Only you. The rest of you, you're going to Medina first, then to Makkah, and then you're going to stay there. Okay. So if you're going to Makkah, and then you're not going to go back to Medina, Munawwara, until after Hajj, if you have to, then most likely you'll be either doing, you could do any of these Hajj then. But most people will do this one first. So now what happens is, this one here, which is the most rewarding one, is you go to Makkah and you put on two ihrams together, which is you make two intentions. You don't take two sets of cloth. You make two intentions. I am, oh Allah, I am doing Umrah and Hajj together. Right? So then what happens is, you go and you start doing Umrah. You finish your Umrah. Umrah takes a few hours. You'll do your Umrah, but then you can't shave your hair or cut your hair. You can't remove your ihram restrictions, because you've also intended Hajj. And for Hajj, you have to wait until the 8th of Dhul Hijjah and do the Hajj. Then you can come out. So because it generally requires you to stay in ihram for longer, it's the most rewarding. And the penalties, if you do anything wrong, are double, because it's a contravention against your ihram and of your Hajj ihram. So it's the most difficult, but it has the greatest reward to it. So if you did Umrah, technically speaking, in Ramadan, as many people do, then you went for Hajj. Because, and then in Hajj you only did Hajj, you would still be doing this Hajj, because your Umrah there would not count towards these three categories, because it's done before the month of Hajj started. The Hajj month starts after Ramadan. So if you do Umrah in after Ramadan, in the months of Hajj, then it would determine what kind of Hajj you can do. You can't change the Hajj once you start it. So if you started with this one, you can't make it this one. If you do this one, then you can't get out of it unless you pay a penalty. So you have to be very careful what you want to do. And obviously you have to have your arrangement with your group has to be conducive. So be very careful what you're going to do. Most people are just going to do this one, which is called Hajj Tamattu. It's the easiest one. This explains the differences. This first one here, the Tamattu, which is the most common one, you do a Umrah when you go into Makkah. Now remember, when you go into Makkah, you're going to have an ihram on. You can't go in there just like that. Anybody going into Makkah from outside has to put an ihram on and go and do something. And what's that going to be? If it's Hajj time, you can do Hajj, or if you're going to do Umrah. So you're going to do a Umrah, and all you intended is a Umrah. So you do Umrah a few hours, and then you cut your hair, shave your hair, and then you're out. You put normal clothing on, and then you can still do your tawaf. Then if you're staying for 5 days, 10 days, 15 days, whatever it is, then your Hajj begins. Then you put another ihram on for Hajj. So here it's two ihrams separately. The pilgrim there is called a mutamattir. How many of you are doing tamattu? Right, majority will be doing tamattu. So you're called mutamattir. Tamattu means somebody who benefits. Tamattu means to benefit. You're benefiting from a Umrah and a Hajj together. That's what it means. Now, the one thing is, because Allah has allowed you to do a Umrah and a Hajj in the month of Hajj, you have to pay a sacrifice. This is what they call the Qurbani, but it's different from the Qurbani that we are obliged to do here. They're two separate things. That's called Damush Shukr. It's called a sacrifice of gratitude for allowing me to do Umrah and Hajj together. Okay? So that's obligatory on this type and this type. The next one, which is the more complicated one, is as soon as you go in, you're doing ihram for both together. That's why you can see the Umrah is within the Hajj. You finish, you do your Umrah, then you stay in ihram, and then you do Hajj, and then you can get out of it. That person is called a Qarin, and that kind of Hajj is called a Qiran Hajj. Qiran means to join and combine. And that also requires a sacrifice, because you've been able to do two things. Number three is Ifrad, which is you're going to go there and intend only Hajj. You're not going to do a Umrah beforehand. That person is called a Mufrid. This is called Ifrad. Ifrad means to do one thing. Fard means singular, to do a singular thing. Mufrid is the one who does a singular thing. And there is no animal sacrifice for this. You can if you want to, but there's no obligation, because you haven't done an Umrah as well. Now, a lot of us will be wondering, but what about if you stay over in Makkah after Hajj and we want to do a few more Umrahs? That's fine. But that doesn't count in this equation. Once you're over here, once your Hajj is finished, then do as many Umrah. You're out of the month of Hajj. So the Umrahs done there do not determine the type that is necessary here. Now why should you bother about the type? Well, because it has there are certain restrictions. If you're in doing this type, then you'll have to pay double penalty, but you get more reward. And all of this actually comes from which Hajj did Rasulullah ﷺ himself do? Which one did he do? And there's a massive difference of opinion there. Because the Sahaba who are narrating, some thought that he did this Hajj, which is the strongest opinion. Others said, no, it was actually this Hajj that he did. So there is that difference of opinion. Let's just look at this. Tamattu is the most common Hajj. It's the one in which you enter Ihram twice and you come out of Ihram in between. Right, the same kind of points that we covered. Just refresh your memory there. The Qiran Hajj. Right? This is the most rewarding one because it's the most difficult one. And then you've got the Ifrad Hajj. The first time I went, this is what I did. And the reason is that I stayed in Medina Munawwara. I went to Medina Munawwara first. We stayed there for like 9 days. And we pushed it until like just the day before Hajj was about to begin. Generally they try to get you out 2 or 3 days before. They try to empty Medina Munawwara out, go to Makkah, get there, because otherwise it's a massive rush. But because we were kind of alone, without a group, just 5 of us, we took a taxi on the last day beforehand. So what we did is we went straight to the Hajj. We put our stuff somewhere and straight to the Hajj. So now, it was very difficult to do a Umrah. There's no time to do a Umrah. You're going into Hajj. So we did Ifrad then. But if you're going to be in Makkah for some days before, then there's no point doing Ifrad. Because then you can't do any Umrah beforehand. So do a Umrah, but this is what I would suggest. If you're going to be in Makkah for just 2 or 3 days before Hajj, then brave the Qiran, if you can. Which means put your Ihram on a bit earlier, a day earlier, half a day earlier, go and do a Umrah, then get into Hajj. It'll take about half a day, but it is really busy. So you have to be really healthy and committed for that. And if you're going to be there for more than a few days, then do tamattu, which most of you are probably doing, because you'll do a umrah, you'll stop, you'll finish it, you'll relax in your normal clothes, you'll go and do tawaf, and then you'll put ihram on for hajj again. The most rewarding hajj according to the Hanafi school is qiran. Because they said that's what the Prophet ﷺ did, followed by tamattu, then ifrad. But as I said, Quran can be difficult, so don't force yourself to do it if you're going to find it really tough afterwards. According to the Shafi'is, Ifrad is superior. Because what they're saying is that if their rationale behind this, if I'm going for Hajj, then I want to make it purely for Hajj. I don't want to do a Umrah in between. And remember, according to Shafi'is, Umrah is a fard. Whereas according to the Hanafis, Umrah is never fard, it's a sunnah. Umrah can never be obligated on you unless you vow it to be obligated on you. But religiously speaking, the Shafi'is, they consider Hajj and Umrah to be similar. So they have a different take on it. And according to the Malikis, Tamattu is the most rewarding, and the whole world is following the Maliki opinion in here. Although it's just a difference of opinion on what's more preferable. We're going to, in our procedure here, we're going to describe tamattu process, because most people are going to do tamattu process, but then we'll explain the differences with the others afterwards. Right, some more theory. Now, the world has been split into 3 different sections with relationship to Hajj. Okay. What are the 3 areas? One is the Haram area, which is where Makkah is. Right. Now, Makkah has sprawled beyond the original sanctified Haram area, as the Prophet ﷺ had delineated. Now, beyond the Haram area, there is an area called the Hill. Hill means, Haram means where things are prohibited. you can't kill animals there, you can't pull down trees, things of that nature. And in comparison to that, the surrounding areas are called hill. But they have a boundary. These are the boundaries. Can you see these boundaries? These are the boundaries. Right? So there's a certain area of so many miles around the haram which is called a hill. Then beyond that, all of this area, is called the afaq, the foreign lands. We are in the afaq. Medina Munawwara here is also afaq. It's outside the hill. Why is that necessary? It's necessary to understand where to put your ihram from and to know if you made a mistake or not. So understand this carefully. Wake up for this. Make sure you understand what you're doing. The most significant thing in this is, where is Jeddah located? Because most of us are going to go to Jeddah. Is that right? Now, that's where we're going to put our ihram from. We're not traveling by land. A lot of other people, they travel by land. They come in their land cruisers. They come in coaches from Syria, other places. We're going in flight. So now, where is Jeddah? The strongest opinion which we follow here is that Jeddah is, as you can see if I take this off, Jeddah is inside the miqat, is inside the hill area. Which means you can't wait until Jeddah to put your ihram on, because you would have already gone past the boundary. This green area is the boundary into which you can't go without an ihram. If you're traveling to the haram, you can't enter into this boundary without putting an ihram on. If you're going to meet somebody somewhere around here, alright, and you're not going to the haram, then you don't need an ihram if you go into this boundary. Right, so nobody's going there for business or anything like that. You know, if you're going to visit relatives first, in somewhere around the haram, in Aziziyah, you've got relatives, then you're going to sit with them, you're not going for Hajj first, then technically you could go in without an ihram. But if I'm going into Makkah, for whatever reason, I have to have an ihram. And when do I have to put the ihram on? Not from Makkah, but from this area here, whichever direction I'm coming in from. So England is here, around here. So we're going to fly like this and get to Jeddah. So, to be careful and cautious, half an hour, 40 minutes before you get to Jeddah, and sometimes they actually tell you as well, that we are passing the miqat now. You need to have had your ihram and your intention and labbaik all done. Some people, they'll start it from here, in Heathrow, that's where they'll have the men will have their garments on, and they'll pray their two rakats, the women as well, and then they'll intend, and now, so why shouldn't you do it from there? Why should you wait to do it on the plane? Reason is that you don't want to mess up. You know, you on the plane, you're still traveling, you don't want to like touch some perfume, hot perfume towel. You know, be careful of those if you're in ihram, by the way. Right, the perfume towels that they give you, the scented hot towels they give you. So what a lot of people do, from home or from Heathrow, they'll have their shower. There's showers in Heathrow as well, but you'd rather just do it from home. And you put your garments on. What I would suggest is you put your bottom, for the men this is more of the issue, you put your garments on, especially the bottom one. You carry the top sheet folded, and you just put something on top. You wear something on top. Maybe a long thawb or a jubba or something covers up your lungi as well, so it's not a problem. You can't wear trousers on top of that. That's going to look weird. Right? So, and then you go, and you get on the flight. Then, three-quarter way through the flight, then that's where you sit on your seat or go and pray. Two rakats. Nafl prayer can be performed outside any city, as long as you're not within city limits. Just casually, anytime, facing in any direction. The Prophet ﷺ used to sit on his animal outside when he was traveling and used to make nafl prayer. So that's permissible. You don't have to repeat it. So this is a sunnah prayer. You sit down, you do two sunnah, and then you sit there and you make your intention before you get to this boundary. Now, if yours is a direct flight in that direction, then it's fine. Some people, they're going on Gulf, Emirates, Qatar. All of that is located on this side. So, essentially you're flying there first. So you're going over the miqat. You may be going over the miqat. And then you're going to come this way. So there you can't wait for 20 minutes before Jiddah, because you would have already passed this miqat. So there you have to start much earlier. And in that case, it's only 2 hour flight or something, I think, from... If you're going to Medina Munawwara first, then this is very simple. You're going to Medina from... You're going to Jiddah, so you're going into the hill area. But, because you're not going to go into Makkah, you're first going to Medina Munawwara. You don't have to worry about Ihram. Yeah, you're going to be saying, but I am going to go to Makkah. Yes, you are, but your first journey is Medina Munawwara. That's your destination. So you go there, and then for people from Medina Munawwara, this is what they'll do. You go Medina first. Now very close, within 45 minutes that you come out of Medina Munawwara, and they will stop at this massive complex. Big masjid, loads of showers and facilities. It's called Dhul Hudayfa. That is the miqat for the people of Medina Munawwara. So, very comfortable place to make your turaqat in the masjid, put your ihram on. I would suggest you have the cloth on from Medina Munawwara, get on your coach, you get there, you just have to wash up if you need to, take a shower if you need to, otherwise just do it in your hotel. And then after that, pray your turaqat and then sit down and make your intention. Right? So, then you'll travel the rest of the way like that. Okay. This is just for informational purposes. People coming from Iraq, they'll come this way. They've got a place called Zatu Irkia, where they have facilities. People coming from the north, this is Dhul Hulayfa, where if you're going to Medina first, that's where you'll be going. It's Qarn al-Manazil. People from the subcontinent, India, Pakistan, when they used to go in ships before, traditionally, they used to use this one, called Yalamlam. That's for people from Yemen that are coming by road. They come through Yalamlam. Or from south of Saudi Arabia, they'll use this one. But as you can see, Jiddah is inside the boundaries. There are some scholars who argue that Jiddah is on the boundary line. So they allow you to go to Jiddah and put your ihram on from there. But that is not the stronger opinion. Though there are some big scholars who agree with that as well. But, I mean, we're doing a journey of a lifetime. You want to take the more precautious way anyway. This is just to give you an idea. This is Haram, right? This is Haram. Medina Munawwara is to the north, as you've already figured out. Jiddah is to the west, is to the left. It's about a 50-minute drive from Jiddah to Medina, to Makkah. So Jiddah is here. You'll go in a coach here, but yeah. And then Mina is here. You can see it's on the opposing side of Jiddah, Mina. And then after Mina is Muzdalifah, is this area, and then this is Arafah. So Arafah is the furthest out. And this whole complex is your Hajj. This whole area is your Hajj area. Personally, I'm very into orientation. I like to know which direction things are. So that's my obsession. So some of you will appreciate and some of you are thinking, I don't need to know that, I'm just going to follow the leader. But it's good to know. Because nowadays with your Google Maps and GPS, download the Google Maps onto your phone so that if you do get lost, as you can quite easily do, right? Especially if you're good at this and you know you can locate yourself, use that facility if you can. But it helps to know which direction you're going. Okay. This is now pre-ihram preparations. So we've done all of the other practical aspects. This is what you have to do to put your ihram on. Now let me clarify one thing quickly. Ihram is not clothing. Ihram is a state. When I say Allahu Akbar, I've just done takbiratul ihram. I've just done the takbir which makes things not allowed in salat impermissible for me. So when I go into ihram and make that intention, I now cannot use fragrance, I can't cut my hair. So it's going into the state of pilgrim sanctity. So ihram means a state, not clothing. Just one of the conditions of that state for men is that they have to have the two sheets. And the condition for women is that they can't cover their face. That's just a condition, and they can't use perfume and so on. So what you want to do is before you start your Hajj and Umrah, clip your nails, remove any pubic hair, and trim your mustache if you want. I'm not going to say trim your beard because that's not a good thing to do anyway, right? And take a bath or at least do wudu. Take a ghusl or at least do wudu. And then put your ihram clothes on. For women, that's any clothing that they want to wear, except that it can't cover their face. We'll get to that in more detail. For men, it's the two sheets. Apply, now, you haven't made intention yet, you've just put the garments on. Put loads of perfume on it, for men. Women can also put some perfume, but it shouldn't be that will leave a scent trail. They can have a special perfume that is just to keep them smelling nice for themselves. Men are allowed to wear more outgoing perfume. Right? So stay away, women should stay away from their Calvin Kleins because they stink and they leave a trail of bad stench on the way, their obsessions and cheap perfume. You should go for Hermes or Guerlain, you know. The more couture brands. Anyway, I'm not promoting anything. But if put lots of itr. Perfume, the problem with a lot of perfume is it smells stale the next day, so you'll be sick of it. So that's the good thing about Hermes, Ter and other perfumes. They don't leave a bad smell the next day. They disappear completely. So get good perfume, aftershaves, or get good itr, pure ouds or, you know, good one, that doesn't smell stale the next day because you're going to be in these clothing. Put lots on your body and your clothing. It's permissible to enter into ihram smelling nice. You just can't apply it afterwards. So try to get those that will keep you smelling nice for a few days because you're going to need it. It's very hot there. So apply lots of perfume to your body and clothing. Women can also use their internal body sprays for this if they want. Perform 2 rakahs of sunnah ihram prayer. Make your intention from your departure airport. Now do this at your departure. I've already said this. Or wait until 46 minutes of Jeddah. If you stop in the Gulf, you can do it from there. I've already covered that. Now these are particular aspects to do with men. The ihram has to be the 2 white sheets. One sheet for the lower part, one sheet for the above. Just make sure your navel is covered. That's all. So you'll have to tie it higher than you generally tie your trousers at your waist. So it should be higher up so it covers the navel. And it shouldn't be too long that it dangles on the floor. It should be above your ankles. But then not too high that your knees become exposed. With the other sheet, you cover the top part. Now, you don't want to be exposing yourself all the time. Right? So for those who, mashallah, have a good build. That's why it's actually makruh to keep your shoulder bare unless you're very hot and you have to just take it off for some reason. Because you don't want women looking at your shoulders for no reason. You only do that in that tawaf that you do. That's not a big problem. The bigger problem for a lot of people who are, mashallah, not so fit, and they have, mashallah, various levels of fat on their body, they're very self-conscious. But you know, once you get there, all of that will die out. All of that will be removed. You'll see the fattest people in the world to the thinnest people in the world, and there's no problem once you get there. No problem. It's just, don't worry about it. First you'll be very conscious, and then after that it's just, who cares? Everybody's like that. So, don't worry about it. It is unlawful for males to wear any clothing other than the sheets. So you can't keep your underwear on, for example. Right? The only time somebody can keep their underwear is if they have a problem of incontinence. And they have to wear a special pad. There's a medical reason, isn't it? But don't consider everything a medical reason. Find out from alim first. But otherwise, you can't wear anything, no t-shirts, nothing inside. I've been actually thinking that we need to design an ihram. Most of it is a thick cotton toweling cloth. We need to have a climacool one. But with thick cloth, so that it wicks away the... Because that can get really hot. But then it's really good because you can go in, have a little shower, put water on yourself, and you go out and you're dry. That's the way to cool you. That's your self-made air conditioning. But Azhar Academy, maybe you can think about a climacool top ihram cloth. The bottom will be too thin for that. Right? footwear must not cover the metatarsals, as I mentioned, or the ankles. And you can perfume your hair, perfume hair oil, coconut oil, might get a bit sickening the next day. But women can even use amla or whatever they use, right, before they go in to ihram, but not afterwards. Ihram for women. Women can continue to wear their everyday stitched clothes, no problem. Just muted colors. Don't wear bright reds and pinks and things like that. She can wear, if women are wearing niqab, and some women, they actually choose to wear niqab when they go to Muslim countries, and those who wear it generally, there is a bit of complication here. You're not allowed to cover your face. What the ulama understand from that is you can't touch the cloth to your face, because covering means you're draping something over your face. So they said, how do you reconcile not covering your face, observing the ihram restriction, at the same time also observing the veil? So what the Arabic books mention is that you get something, they say you get something protruding, which nowadays is a sun cap, and you put the niqab over it. So that's why I've just got a picture of that. It's something, this is like one of those sun caps, and it has the cloth going over it. Now, this from experience, for a lot of women who wear niqab, they find it very difficult, especially if they have bad eyesight. Because, even for those who have good eyesight, and it's dark outside, very difficult to see through, because when the cloth is right next to your face, it's easier to see through, even with a thicker cloth, or you have the opening. When it's a distance away, the cloth is going to have to be thinner, and sometimes it's translucent, you can see through it. So you've got these women with niqab on, but you can still see their face, so it's not fulfilling the purpose. So others, that you see a lot of women, you'll see from Arab countries, they'll just put the niqab on. I don't know if it's allowed them, what fatwa they're following, they just put it on, khalas, you know, they just put it on. But many of the women that go from the UK, South Africa, India, Pakistan, they'll have these contraptions. And you have to be very careful that you can walk around in them. So after a lot of thought, I mean, essentially, there's so many people there that the ulama say you can even remove your niqab. But for many women who've been wearing niqab for years, it's very difficult. They feel so self-conscious and exposed when they uncover their face in front of people. Especially when you're traveling with people you know. You know? So we came up with an idea last year that what you do is you get a hat like this. So you've got your scarf. I'm speaking obviously to the women and for the guys who can pass this on to their women folk. You get a hat like this. This is actually a very good one you can buy from Amazon that actually folds up as well. It's going to cover your face because it's going to come down to about here. Right? And if you look down and you're not exceptionally tall, nobody's going to see you unless you look up. And then along with that, some women can have these massive sunglasses on, you know, those big oversized sunglasses, but that doesn't cover your bottom part of your jaw, so that doesn't work as well. But really, this will cover half of your face, and you can walk around like that. It won't even attract attention. This attracts more attention, but if that's what they want to do, they can use that. This attracts less attention. And you can look down and then have one of those fans that they carry around. And whenever you do come in front of you, put the fan in front of your face and you move around. Otherwise, you're generally going to be in your tent with the women anyway. You know, generally there's no dual gender, they're all segregated. The tents are segregated generally, you know, between men and women. But it's outside when you go outside. Aisha radiallahu anha, in her Hajj hadith, she mentions that We had our face uncovered. Whenever somebody would come up, then we would just kind of put our scarves over like that, that's what we're talking about here. So find something that's comfortable for you. Women are allowed to wear gloves, socks, normal shoes. They've got no problem. Just wear comfortable shoes. Women menstruation, postnatal bleeding, they should also take a shower. They should also take a shower for their ihram, even though they can't pray. But the only thing they can't do is they can't make the two rakats of ihram prayer. And the other difference is that women will say their labbaik in a low voice as opposed to loudly. Men on the streets will be saying labbaik, Allahumma labbaik, but women will say it silently. And another thing which we probably have to have a more concentrated discussion on is the use of the pill during ihram, because that can be one of the greatest horrors for women, that they are in Hajj, they haven't done their tawaf, and their menstruation begins, and they've already got a booking that is leaving in 3 days, what are they going to do? So there are some strategies there that you can use. And you have to, women who their menstrual time is going to come around that time, they have to pre-plan properly, and things can still go wrong. Because when you're traveling, your system doesn't work as normal, and things happen that you don't expect it to happen. Just make dua to Allah to make it easy for you. Otherwise, it causes, because you can't change your flights in many cases. Then what do you have to do? Then there are some big penalties involved and things of that nature. It gets complicated. So we'll discuss that later. Okay, what you've done so far, you put your garments on, you've done your turakats, you've put your perfume, etc. on that you wanted to, clip your nails, you've done your turakats, and you are now ready to do your intention. Perform turakats. Men can leave their... See, until now you're not in ihram yet, so you can keep your hat on, even with your ihram. Then you make a dua, but remove your hat now. It's very easy to forget removing your hat, and you enter the ihram intention and you still got your hat on. Right? So remove your hat. The best thing is have a group of people and be helping each other. If you try to do it yourself, believe me, you can forget. Last year, I think I kept my hat on and somebody just nudged me and then I took it off. So we can make mistakes. Now, you do the intention and then you read Labbaik Allahumma Labbaik. When you do the intention, O Allah, and the intention is coming soon, O Allah, I am intending Umrah, make it easy for me and accept it from me. That's your intention. You don't have to verbally say it, it's in your mind. So you can verbally say it if you want to. But then you verbally say Labbaik Allahumma Labbaik. لبيك لا شريك لك لبيك إن الحمد والنعمة لك والملك لا شريك لك لبيك اللهم لبيك. So when once you've said that, now you're in ihram. Now all the restrictions apply. So as soon as you make the intention and read the talbiyah, you're in the state of ihram. Not just intention, not just talbiyah, both of them. Saying لبيك is called talbiyah. Now make sure you memorize it before you go there. Just say it a few times over and over and you'll learn it. These are the intentions. Allahumma inni uridu al-umrah fayassirha li wa taqabbalha minni. If you're doing tamattu, first you're going to do a umrah, so that's your intention for umrah. Then you come out of ihram, you finish your umrah, then on the 8th of Zilhijjah, you're going to do ihram again. That ihram you're going to do from your hotel room. You do from Makkah itself. That's when you make the second intention. You'll find this intention in most Hajj books anyway. But if you want to take them down, it's up to you. Qiran intention is double. Allahumma inni uridu al-umrata wal-hajj. Oh Allah, I desire to perform both umrah and hajj together. Make them easy for me and accept them from me. And the intention of ifrad is the same as this one, because it's singular for hajj only. The talbiyah, labbaik Allahumma labbaik, labbaik la sharika laka labbaik, innal hamda wa ni'mata laka wal mulk la sharika laka. Now know what it means. You don't want to be saying something there, you don't know what it means. Here I am, O Allah. I know some people from some countries who did this in English. Here I am, O Allah, here I am. This sounds kind of weird. Keep it Arabic, keep it real in Arabic. But know what it means. Here I am, O Allah, here I am. There is no partner for you. Here I am. Verily, all praise is to you. Every bounty is for you. All dominion is yours. You have no partner. Pure expression of absolute submission. And it's a response. I've answered your call. I'm coming. I'm here for you and for nobody else. And in your practice, make that real. How long do you read the talbiyah for? As soon as you put ihram on in London or on the plane, you'll start doing it. How long do you read it for? It depends whether you're doing umrah or hajj. In umrah, as soon as you go into the haram and you see the Kaaba for the first time, then you stop in umrah. In hajj, you continue to do it until You do it through Mina, Arafah, Muzdalifah, until the 10th, where you go and do the first stoning and you stop there. So you stop only when you've done the first stoning and you've finished all the other rituals. When do you do it? Because it's difficult to continuously do it. If you can, alhamdulillah, it's whenever you remember and as much as possible. It's your expression to Allah. But at least when ascending a place or descending a place, going down from your hotel, going up to your hotel, joining a party of people, whenever you're changing your situation, after each salat, in the morning and the evening. Alright, this is just a comprehensive list of general prohibitions in Ihram. And let's go through these. Most of these you should know. Men cannot wear sewn clothing. Shirts, turbans, cloaks, hooded cloaks. This allows you to wear like a cloak that is just a sheet that you just put over your shoulder because it's not in a body form. What is prohibited really is clothing in a body form. That means many ulama, they actually allow your bottom ihram sheet to be sewn. Because it's not sewn in the form of your body. But I would avoid it. You don't need to. There's ways of tying ihram. And now you can buy these woven tubular ihrams that don't have any stitching at all. Right? And they're tubes. But they may be more difficult to put on unless you use a belt. Men cannot wear gloves, but if you have to wrap your hands for picking something up or because they're blistered, you can wrap something around them because that's just a wrap, that's not gloves with your fingers. You can't cover your hair. Men can't cover their hair. So you can't wear a hat. You can't put your ihram over your head because it's like a hood. But you can hold it over your head without touching it. The other thing you have to be careful of is when you're wiping after wudu, don't cover your face completely like that, because then you've covered your face. Kind of like do one side first and the other side first, both for men and women. And likewise, if you want to, don't put the whole towel on your head and start scrubbing it. Or women, normal clothes, but they can't cover their faces. Be careful of scented hot towels. Okay, these are the other prohibitions. You can't apply any kind of perfume to your body or clothing afterwards. You can enter with it, but you can't apply it new. What happens if you want women to change their clothes, or men to put another ihram, new ihram on? Some people would have an intention of carrying a second set of ihram with them. I think it's too much. You don't want to carry the ihram cloth throughout. It's not necessary. If your ihram gets a bit dirty, go into these baths and these showers I show you. Just wash it in there, come out, and you'll be dry in 10-15 minutes anyway. Right? But let's just assume you've got a separate... If that is perfumed, you can't wear that now. If you've got... Women have got a change of clothes and they want to change within the ihram period, you can't wear perfumed cloth. So make sure that you don't use any fabric conditioner, or go and find a scentless, fragrance-free, especially for women, they should do this, fragrance-free washing liquid or powder, and wash their clothes with that, the ones they're going to wear during ihram. Of course, scented soaps are not allowed, toothpaste, mint, mouthwashes, even scented food, minty food, so mints are not allowed. Chewing gum is a problem. Because they have a fruity smell. Curries are fine, unless they've got a special saffron, exotic spice smell. Alright? Saffron is a problem. Vanilla, rose essence, all of these things are an issue. Of course, sexual intercourse and anything leading to it. Which means even a discussion of how somebody looks, a sexually charged discussion, of course, or with your spouse, of a sexual nature, or touching for that. You can hold, many men and women, husband and wife, they hold their hands, they don't get lost, that's fine, but you can't, you have to keep your mind clear. Especially if you're newly married, it's a bit of a challenge sometimes. removing hair from any part of the body. For Umrah, it doesn't matter, it's just a few hours. But this is mainly an issue in Hajj. Clipping your nails is not allowed. And killing lice or any animals except harmful ones. So if you see some bugs in your room and you can't kill them, you'll have to call one of the workers or something, tell them to take care of it. You can't. You'd be penalized for that. These are permissible things. Now, you're probably wondering, why do I have a list of permissible things when there are billion things that are permissible in Ihram? Walking, looking, you know. So why do you think we have permissibilities that we've listed here? These are the ones that are generally confused. So it's just clarificational permissibilities. Some people say, I can't cover my head, so I can't use an umbrella. You can. It's not touching your head, it's fine. Because umbrellas can be useful down there when you're walking to pelt the shaitans, because it's going to be scorching heat. Roof of a car, tent, it's all fine. Carrying your bags on top of your head are also fine, because you're not covering your hair as such, you're just covering. Carrying a backpack is fine as well, even if it's sewn. People have asked this question, I've got sewn sandals, a sewn belt, is that a problem? No, it's not an issue. Stitched belts are fine. Wearing, I've mentioned that already, ring or a watch is fine as well. Wearing eyeglasses, of course. Contact lenses. Cleansing yourself with unscented cleansers is fine, but be careful of them because a lot of them actually have a scent. But it's best not to use them except when you come out of the toilet. Then that's probably the only time I would justify using that, because you don't want a bad smell on your hands either. Washing or scratching your head and body is fine, but if you're a person who sheds hair easily, then a few hair do fall, just a few, when you scratch your beard or hair, then give some sadaqah for that happening. Washing your ihram garments or putting on new unscented ones is also fine. Let's orient ourselves again. We've gotten to Jeddah. If you're going first to Medina Munawwara or you're going to Makkah, it doesn't matter. If you're going through Jeddah, you're going to need a lot of patience. It's unlike being in any other airport where you go and show your passport. If they want to check you out, they'll check you, check your luggage, and you go. Here, you could be there for 5, 6, 7 hours. Literally. There are so many people coming in. I'm hoping they're better this year. And they've got people who they've had to just draft in, sometimes younger, 17, 18 years old, to do all of this procedure. They check your passport, your visa. They check if you've got your vaccination, your certificates, you need them. Otherwise, I think they force you to take some pill down there. Right? And then they check your luggage to see if you've got any contraband material, especially books and things like that. They have an issue with things like that. But just takes long time to make you sit and things like that. The benefit of the group I'm going with is that we got a charter flight to Medina and Munawwara directly. It's less used. When you get there, within an hour we were out. That saves a huge amount of time. Then finding once you even get out of all of the procedure here, then finding your transport, your bus, your coach, to get to Makkah or to Medina Munawwara, it's going to take a long time. So your difficulties will start from there. So have lots of patience right from there. Now, inshallah, you're in Ihram. On the way, they give out food, they give out stuff, they give out a lot of things. They're very generous down there. They give out a lot of things. The Hajj ministry, they give lots of things. If not, then there's places to buy things. Carry some basic snacks with you. Carry, during Mina, Arafat and all that, yes, they will feed you if that's part of your package. But it's always good to carry some things that are easy to carry and are nutritious. Crisps are out of the way, they're all carbs. Chocolate, it depends on what type of chocolate. The more darker chocolate it is, the more energy it will give you. But peanuts, nuts are very good, sustainable. Things like dried fruits, like dried apricots and things like that are supposed to be very good. They'll also help you, well, it depends on what problem you have, whether it's diarrhea or constipation, it just depends. But think of things like that. be careful of what kind of energy bars you take. Some of them are just loads of sugar. They're not really energy bars. They're just like instant hit energy bars. And then they give you a downer. Get those that are more sustainable, the more quality ones. Right? So look at that. I'll try to get some suggestions for that next year. But keep these things with you. It's well worth it. It's well worth it to keep these things with you. So you get to Makkah finally. And go to your hotel first. Relax for a while. Now, what does Umrah comprise of? We want to one is the procedure, but the other is the essential elements, which is important to know so that you know if you miss this, then your Umrah is gone. And if you miss this, then it's not gone, you can salvage it. So, you have what you call the fard and the wajib. They're both essential, but if you miss a fard, it's like you're missing the pillar, there's not going to be a structure. If you're missing a wajib, you're missing the walls, but you still got a roof over your head, so it can still be salvaged. They're both essential though. Fard, there's only two fara'id, obligations in Umrah. One is making the intention. And number two, it's to go into ihram by making intention, saying talbiyah. Ihram is one. Number two, tawaf of the Kaaba. Two things. Then, the wajibat are sa'i. Sa'i is going between the mounts of Safa and Marwa after the tawaf. That's a wajib. And after that, shaving or cutting your hair. So you've got four things to do. That's it. Ihram is, it just depends then how long it takes you from when you put your ihram to get to Makkah, get to your hotel, go to the haram, and then go and do tawaf. Tawaf takes about an hour maximum, depends on where you do it. Then you go and drink zamzam, and then you go to Safa Marwa. You do the sa'i, that takes about an hour as well. And then you come down from there, and there's all of these shops there, barbers, you get your hair cut. Women probably have to wait until they get to their hotel room. They cut their hair, you're out. Once you get to Makkah, it takes about 3-4 hours maximum. That's your Umrah. But these are the essential elements. How much hair do you have to cut? It says here, approximately 1 inch. What it is really is as much as goes around your fingertip, which is about an inch of hair, of 25% of your hair. For men, that's going to be weird to cut only 1 inch of 25% of your hair unless you've got very long hair and you're going to do 4 umrahs. And you don't want to shorten your hair too much. The only people that are going to cut 25% or could use this allowance are people who've got long hair or women who don't want their hair to get too short by cutting 1 inch each time off. Alright? So they cut 25% first. This is just strategies I'm giving them if they don't want to shorten their hair too much. Next time do another 25%. Next time do another 25%. And then straighten it when you have to. Otherwise, for women, Aisha radiallahu anha, her hair was very short because she used to do lots of Umrah and Hajj. So you cut 1 inch, another inch, that's 2 inches gone. You do another Umrah, 3 inches, 3 inches are gone. What do men do? We don't have that big hair. So if you've got hair that's bigger than enough to go around your finger, then you cut that off. And if you've got longer hair, then you can cut that much off. But there are 3 times more reward for those who shave their head. The Prophet ﷺ said, "Oh Allah, have mercy on those who shave their head. Allah forgive those who shave their hair in Hajj." Shaving your head is only a sunnah in Hajj, not in any other time. Shaving your head is not a religious thing. Only in Hajj it is. Alright? So, if you shave your head, 7 days later, 5 days later, you're going to do Hajj. And now you have to shave your head again. What do you do? Well, you'll have some. There will be a stubble on your head. They'll just shave it again. What you can do the first time is tell them to put a zero machine on. Don't shave it the first time for Umrah. If you've got small hair anyway, just do a zero machine. That's enough. And the next time that you go, you do a shave. But believe me, shave is much nicer. It's good to have that shave once in a while. So get that shave and do it again. What happens if you did the Umrah today, then you did another one at night? You just shaved your head in the morning or in the afternoon. Now you're doing it at night again. You have to. You can't cut anything, there's nothing there. So they just pass the razor over your head. And mashallah, the barbers make a lot of money those days. And their prices go up at that time as well. And if you want an additional income when you go there, just take a nice hair cutting kit and set up in the lobby of your hotel privately. After Hajj, people are just looking, there's massive queues. and you could make a bit of money. I remember in the hotel we were, the workers there just set up this hair barber salon at the back and were just cutting people's hair. Be careful who you get your hair cut by. You know, there's cuts and things as well that you have to be careful about. For women, again, now you can have your hair cut by someone who's in ihram. There is this misunderstanding out there that the person who cuts your hair has to be out of ihram. So you could technically cut each other's hair if you take a machine with you in your rooms. Right? And for women, they can cut their hair, their husband can cut their hair, or somebody else, the women, they do it themselves in their rooms. Shafi'is, I believe they only have to cut a few hairs. I believe we have some Shafi'is here, just want to try to cut, where I know the Shafi'i opinion, I'll mention it to you. They only have to cut a few hairs, as far as I know. That's why you see some people, they'll come out of tawaf, sorry, out of their sa'i, and then they'll just have a scissors and just cut a few hairs and they're out. But the Hanafis can't do that. Another thing that women need to avoid is you'll see some women, they'll finish their sa'i, and right there in front of everybody, they'll just cut their hair. And that's haram, it's wrong. You can't expose your hair to anybody else. Okay. From Jeddah, on reaching Makkah, check into your hotel. Relax for a while. Don't rush unless you're fine. You would be tired, especially after those several hours in the airport. You're probably going to be tired. You don't want to go in the masjid and be tired. But if you can't help it, then go. It just depends on your state. But it's completely fine. Get some food, get some rest there. It's mustahab to do a ghusl. Even though you've done one before, you've been traveling obviously. It's ghusl is a sunnah to do in Makkah, for the sake of Makkah. Right? Have something to eat if you require. Prepare to go to the masjid. Now, this is very important. Be reading the talbiyah. Now imagine this, you've just checked into your hotel, you've come down, you've gone there, relaxed for a while, had something to eat, you come down the elevators, now you're going. And I remember the first time that I went, when I got to Makkah. With Medina Munawwara, you can kind of see it from a distance, though it's getting more difficult now because of the large high-rises that are coming up. Makkah is just totally covered, surrounded. Unless you get a room in one of those big towers overlooking the Kaaba. That's not as good. It's not as good. What you want to do is you don't want to see the Kaaba and you don't want to let your gaze fall on the Kaaba until you find a nice space in the masjid to be able to see it. And then just pour your heart out. So what you do is you come out, you're walking through the street saying labbaik, and you're in this emotional state. You just can't wait to see it now. And then you come around that final corner and you see the outside darker marble than Medina Munawwara is all white. But here it's kind of this darker marble with shades of black in it. And it is just awesome. You just get taken aback. You haven't even seen the Kaaba yet. You've just seen the outside of the masjid. And it is amazing. And subhanAllah, that just you just want to get in. Now, most of you will be going in from King Abdul Aziz Gate. That's kind of the most popular gate because that is right in front of these big clock tower structures. And the Hilton, all of that is... The only problem with going in that gate is that you get a direct line of vision to the Kaaba. At least you did until last year. Things are changing. The problem with that is you see the Kaaba and that's the opportunity. The first time they say you see the Kaaba, your du'as are accepted. So you don't want to like just be in the doorway. So what I would suggest, I'll show you on the map later, is to go from one of the other doors from the King Fahd entrance or from one of the doors to the left-hand side of the King Abdul Aziz gate. But you go through that, and there's a wall next to you, so you go through that, and then when you turn around the corner, you can see the Kaaba, and there's space there, generally, for you to just stand, and just pour your heart out, cry, because when you see the Kaaba for the first time, it's going to look different from what you see in the pictures. You're going to think of it to be of a particular size. And when you see it there, the Kaaba in the middle, people just going around it, this, it's like an ocean, and people swimming around it, and it is just, you can't help it. They did a documentary of three individuals that went to Kaaba on, I think, CNN or PBS or something. And even though these guys were being filmed, they couldn't help crying. you know, you're on video, but you just can't help it. It's just amazing. And there you're supposed to just talk to Allah and ask for whatever. Does anybody know the best dua that you can make down there? I know you do. Anybody? Right, whose dua is it? Right, so it's famously known that Imam Abu Hanifa rahimahullah, when he would go, he's a very intelligent individual. He says, well, if the du'as of this time are going to be accepted, then let's make a du'a that's going to accept all my du'as. So, oh Allah, make me of those whose every du'a is accepted. Now, it's up to Allah to give it to us or not, but it's an opportunity to ask that thing. And just stand there, spend time. Before you're going to do your tawaf, make as much du'a as possible. I'll be speaking about what kinds of du'as you need to make. I'll be speaking about that later. Right. Now, it's sunnah to enter through Babu Salam. Because that's where the Prophet ﷺ entered from. Now, a lot of people will never find out where Babu Salam is nowadays. But Babu Salam gate is actually the one which is, it's one of the gates that is through the Safa Marwa area. It's one of the gates on that side. I'll try to point it out later on. But it's quite a bit of a task, especially if you've got less days and you're coming in from the King Abdul Aziz side. It's very difficult to go and find that gate, especially the first time. Last year, though I'd been twice before, it was so confusing, I don't know where what was. There's all these new structures coming and you think I should go this way, but no, it's this way. And it was just very difficult. It's like a massive Olympic scale thing we're talking about. Really big, it's just very difficult. So, most people can't observe that today. Continue to look down. And I mentioned that already. Okay, here. This is Safa Marwa. And the Salam gate is in here somewhere. Now, this is the King's Palace. These are the King's Palaces. They're eventually going to go. All of this area is gone. There's no hotels here anymore. And if you are coming, this is the King Abdul Aziz gate here. Most of you will be staying around here, in this area, so you'll come in from here. But as I said, go in from here. Or here, or King Fahd Gate is here. And better still, going from kind of here, and there's like a wall here. So you go in from here, and then when you get there, that's when you can stop, see the Kaaba, and make your dua. Last year, we were staying in Aziziyah. So our coach came and dropped us off somewhere here, so we had to come this way. And it was so difficult to find out where to go, and then you have to go through the Safa Marwa area, and into there. Now you're going to do tawaf. You've made your dua. Now the way I look at it is like getting ready for a swim. Standing at the edge of the pool, getting ready to dive in. Right? For some people that's how it feels. It's a sea of people and you're going to be dealing with those waves. Now what you don't want to do is you go around like this, anti-clockwise. Let's assume that you're starting from here. Don't go here and try to cut through the people and go directly to the starting line in a straight direction. You're wasting your time. It's against crowd movement because the pressure is coming this way. You're trying to cut through that. It's ridiculous. Go down, walk down here or here and go into the crowd from there. You're going to be on the outskirts. If you want to build into, women should stay on the outskirts. It's really suffocating in between. And Unfortunately, there is haram that goes on. There are perverts there, unfortunately. People, whether they're purposely or whatever. That's why if a husband and wife team are going, generally what the men do is they stand in the back and their wife stands in front of them and they kind of keep their hands on their sides just so that nobody kind of pushes. And it's not even purposeful sometimes. It's just, that's the crowd. Be very careful. So women generally tend to stay on the outside. You do get these big women from different countries and all, they will just charge you. And it doesn't matter what happens, they will just, they'll topple you over if they have to. That's obviously wrong, but things like that unfortunately do happen. You're standing by the Kaaba making dua, and a woman come and push you. Or she'll come and stand right next to you. What can you do then? In fact, I want to carry on making dua, but this woman is like right next to you. What are you going to do? You're going to have to say, alright sister, carry on, I'm going. Right? So, women have that advantage if they want to be that aggressive, but it's haram. It's wrong. They have to be observant of these things. So don't ever, like, if you want to get to the Kaaba or the Black Stone, just go right in. Go in from here and then start working yourself into a comfortable position. And then when you get to the Black Stone where you have to start your tawaf from to make your intention, it's easier to do. But best is not to get into the crowd if you, especially the first few times, until you get used to making the istilam, the special intention of how you start your tawaf. Start it from the edge. So just kind of go to the edge and then work your way around. So, because this is your umrah tawaf, right? This is something specific for men. You're going to have your ihram cloth and you're going to have to do what you call two things. Istiba and ramal. Ittiba is to put your ihram on in a particular way. I'll show you that later. But it's to expose your right shoulder. So you take your ihram upper sheet and you just put it from underneath and then you fling it over your left hand side while your right arm fully uncovered. So you have to do that for all seven of the circuits. In that entire tawaf. You have to do ittiba when you have an ihram on in any tawaf after which you're going to do a sa'i. So you don't have to do it in any subsequent tawafs which are just nafil tawafs. Or if you don't have ihram on, then you don't have to do it. You only do it when you have ihram on, the sheets on, and only men do this, women don't do this. Alright? And you only do it when you're going to do a sa'i afterwards. That's one thing. The other thing that you have to do is for the first three circuits, you have to do a marching, brisk walk. Which means you move your shoulders a bit, and you take shorter steps, but you walk briskly, almost as if you're doing a soldier's march. Where this comes from is that when the Prophet ﷺ emigrated to Medina Munawwara, and then they wanted to come back, and they were allowed to come back in the 6th or 7th year, the people of Makkah started saying that, oh, everybody's become emaciated, everybody has become thin, they've lost their energy because Medina Munawwara has a lot of diseases, etc., etc. So the Prophet ﷺ said to everybody that, I want you to march to show your strength. So we take that from there. But you only have to do that in the first three circles. The rest of the four you walk normally. Now, how are you going to do that march when the crowds are big? And in Hajj, the crowds will be very intense. Of course, if you're doing on the upper floors, then there's lots of space there. A lot of people, they do their tawaf on the upper floors in the masjid. It just takes much, much longer. 2 hours sometimes. It's a longer circuit. And on the top floor, for those who want to jog a bit, they can do that on the top floor because there's less people and they can do that. But around the best place to do your tawaf, but it's not for everybody, is right around the Kaaba. Right around the Kaaba. That's where I generally want to do it. But it's difficult. If you're tall, it helps because you can get some air. If you're short, it gets really complicated. There's a lot of pressure there. Anyway, you do ramal. That's what you call ramal. This marching is called ramal only in the first three. Now, if there's too busy and you can't, then you just walk and just moving your shoulders a bit. Just try to do as much of it as possible until you find some space and then you do it. Stop, enter the mataf area. Remember, wudu is necessary for this. Wudu is necessary for this. Women aren't allowed to go in if they're on menstruation. They'll have to wait. Because although they're allowed to do tawaf, they can't go in the masjid to do it. Because women with menstruation are not allowed to go in the masjid. So they'll just have to sit. They can sit outside or they can sit in their room and just remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You need wudu for your tawaf to count. So make sure you have wudu. If it breaks in between, go out, make your wudu, come back and continue from where you left off. You stop making, because this is Umrah, as soon as you see the Kaaba, you stop doing your talbiyah. You've entered the mataf area. Mataf area is where you do tawaf. That white area in between. Then you stand in front of the Kaaba and you make an intention. The way you stand is you have to stand in line with the black stone. That's the starting point. Before they used to have a marker on the ground so you could find it. Now they've taken it off because everybody was so obsessed with it. They used to look for it. It used to spoil the movement. So now there's no longer any. And you don't have to be like perfectly in line. You just... What else helps is that the biggest crowd by the Kaaba and the policeman, there's going to be a policeman by the black stone, right? So that's one, you can see it. And on this side, what you can see is generally there's a green light on the wall. So you try to get yourself in between the green light on the wall, if they still have the green light, they've had it until last year, and the black stone. And you'll see lots of people putting their hands up there anyway. So you get there and you will, what do you do? Raising the hands, you say, you intend that I'm starting my tawaf. Obviously you're there, your intention is there. You don't have to say anything verbally. But, oh Allah, this is what I perform tawaf of umrah to please you, make it easy for me and accept it for me. It's a thought in your mind. Oh Allah, I'm doing tawaf for you. Now raise your palms towards the black stone and say, Bismillah Allahu Akbar walillahil hamd. Bismillah Allahu Akbar walillahil hamd. Drop your hands. Now point your palms towards the black stone and kiss them. You can do this in one movement as well. You're not, because in the second, third, you're going to have to, it's going to be too busy for you to relax and do this. So you just say, Bismillah Allahu Akbar, and then kiss your hands. What you're doing is, what you're supposed to really do is to go and kiss the black stone. But that's a virtual impossibility, near impossibility. So you just do it from afar. You wave to it, you greet it. It's called istilam. Istilam means to greet, do salam. Of the black stone, you kiss your hand, and then you start. So, this is a bit of a diagram here. Black stone, door of the Kaaba. This is the Hatim, Hijr Ismail. And these are then the other corners. As I said, come in from here and build your way in. Don't come in and try to get in the middle. Yes, if you come in from here and you're there, it's fine. Okay. Now what you do is, you start from here. There's no black line here. You start. And then you start moving anti-clockwise. Every time you can't cut a corner. You can't go through there. This part here is considered to be part of the Kaaba. But it was left out of the building process some time ago. I'll explain that later. So you have to go around it. Now, there is no special zikr that's mentioned anywhere here, until you come to this Yemeni corner. This direction is Yemen, that direction is Syria, this direction is Iraq. That's why it's called the Yemeni corner, Iraqi corner, and so on. When you come to here, this is the only other corner that is a virtue to touch it. But that's only going to be possible if you're doing tawaf right here. If you're doing tawaf here, don't even bother. You can't do it from afar. You can only touch it. This one you can't do from afar. Right? But in between this area here, there's a special dua that is from the sunnah. Everybody should know that dua. Rabbana atina fid dunya hasana wa fil akhirati hasana wa qina azab an-nar. Just keep reading that until you get here. Oh our Lord, give us the best in this world, give us the best in the hereafter, and protect us, give us refuge from the hellfire. That's the only dua. Here, what do you do then? Well, you can have a kitab, you can just make your own du'as, you can do any other dhikr, you can read Quran, you can do whatever you want. Just don't disturb people. Sometimes, if you've got your own group, somebody could be doing it slightly loudly. You'll see lots of people doing that. Women should be careful of saying anything aloud, and be careful of what kind of du'a you make. One experience that I had is that there was this woman, probably from India, Pakistan, and she was the brave one leading her group, and she was the one making du'a aloud. Now, that's bad enough to raise your voice like that there, but on top of that, this is what she was saying, and I still remember this very clearly, and I was cringing at every word she was saying. She was saying, Allahumma azillani yawma la zilla illa zilluk. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. The dua is, Allahumma azillani yawma la zilla illa zilluk. And she's saying, azillani yawma la zilla illa zilluk. And you know the difference? Is massive. The meaning of the real dua is, oh Allah, give me shade on the day when there's no shade except your shade. Zil is shade in Arabic. She's saying zil. And you know what zil means? It means humiliation, degradation. Oh Allah, degrade me, humiliate me on the day when there's no degradation or humiliation except your degradation. I was like, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. I just wasn't close enough to tell her. Now of course, men could make that mistake as well. Right there, you'll hear Allahu Akbar. These are different pronunciations that they have of different countries. Alright, I mean, if you're particular about these things, it will kind of ring in your ears, but just focus on yourself. Focus on yourself. But the main thing here is just to feel, I'm doing this for Allah. So it's not just this kind of aimless circuits you're doing. I am doing this for Allah. Right? Now, each time you go past this line, you've done one circuit. That's an additional circuit each time. Right? Every time you go past here. So you have to go past 7 times. But each time you have to do istilam again. Which means you stand at this line, face the Kaaba there, and you say Bismillah Allahu Akbar Walillahil Hamd and kiss your. But it's difficult to do that when it's a big crowd. They'll just push you on. So what you do is, as soon as you get there and you're in the crowd, just one hand, Bismillah Allahu Akbar Walillahil Hamd, carry on. I try to be very fast and do that and then carry on. Because you say, well, why can't I just do tawaf sideways? You can't. It's not counted. That's the thing that a lot of people don't know. You have to, it's your left shoulder. You are going around the Kaaba. And the only way that that becomes true is if your left shoulder is facing it. So you shouldn't even look at the Kaaba. They say, don't even look at the Kaaba while you're doing tawaf. The only place you should look at it is when you do istilam, if you can. So only there, you look around quickly, you move like this, Bismillah, Allahu Akbar, Wallahu Alhamd, carry on. If you're in a rush, if you're pushed around. Otherwise, any part of the tawaf that is done with your chest facing it, or with your back facing it, you have to do that part again. And a lot of time you can't retrace your steps, the crowd won't let you. So, what do? You have cancel that one, you just carry on and you don't count that when you do an extra one. And if you do get doubtful about how many circuits, you just assume the least and then do more. Sometimes it gets so crazy down there that, and people are pushing, you have to kind of hold up the crowd. But you can only do that if you're, otherwise you get squashed, suffocated. So don't go in there if you can't deal with it. There's enough places outside. There's a certain pleasure of doing Kaaba, the tawaf right around the Kaaba. Right around. Certain pleasure. The only place it gets difficult is here. What generally happens is you start off and you're right. Sorry. You start off and you kind of get in. But by here you can get in. You can be right by this wall and right round here. You can get to touch this as well. But when you get here, there's no way you can get through there. You'll have to go out because there is a massive commotion going on here. From all sides, people are trying to get a kiss of the stone. So there are multiple forces of energy coming in. And you could get in, but because there's another energy, you can get flung out here. You get right there and then you're flung off. Right? There's a trick of how to do this without troubling anybody. Most Hajj classes you'll go to, they'll just say, don't even try. They'll say, don't even try. I have a different approach to this. I follow Abdullah ibn Umar in this. Right? My approach is different, which is that you should try. But don't trouble anybody. Don't harm anybody in the process. They say you will harm people in the process because you'll have to shove. I say you don't have to shove. You have to be shoved. Right? There's a way to do it. And maybe at the end I can explain how that is. Alhamdulillah, it's always been successful. But it does help to be a bit taller. It does help. Right? Okay. This shows you that same area like that. Does anybody know there's 2 minarets in one place? And what that represents? What does that represent? It represents King Abdul Aziz Gate. Right? If you want to know where you are and you want to get your bearing, once you're in, sometimes it's very difficult, it's quite a large area. It looks so small here. But if you're here and you don't know and you want to get out now and you want to find your gate, there's no point going here and then having to walk all the way around. Right? How are you going to work out which direction to go in? So you might be here. You don't want to walk all the way around to King Abdul Aziz Gate is represented by these 2. It's the only one that has 2 minarets. So look around, you'll see the minarets, and you can figure that out. And this is a very old picture, because that's the Hilton, I believe, and that's the palace. And now you'll be able to see the clock tower up here somewhere. Right? There's no way you can miss that. So you'll know which way you're going. Okay, the Rukn al-Yamani. That Yemeni corner, as I mentioned, is the only one you can touch if you're close to it. And then Rabbana Atina fi dunya hasana. The Hatim, they say that, you see what happened with the Hatim was, in the time of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, early on, the Kaaba was rectangular. Then it became really old and it was about to fall, so the Quraysh got some money together, but they insisted that the money had to be fully halal. And they had only enough to make it square, so they left this section out. So it's part of the original Kaaba. The Prophet ﷺ wanted to redo it, but he said, look, people have just spent a lot of money and they're very close to having become Muslim and I don't want to upset their sensitivity. So he didn't do it. Later on, Abdullah ibn Zubayr, when he became the governor of Medina, Munawwara, he decided to do it. He did it. So he made it rectangular. He put the doorway of the Kaaba on ground level and two doors, one to go in, one. Because the reason for the Quraysh putting it high is so they can restrict people going in there, who they want, as it is today. So how did it get back to where it is right now? Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, the governor of Abdul Malik ibn Marwan of the Umayyad dynasty, he hated Abdullah ibn Zubayr. So after he had him killed, he destroyed that Kaaba again and he made it back to how it was. Then after his time, some of the ulama came to Imam Malik and said, can we make it back to how the Prophet ﷺ had originally wished it to be and Abdullah ibn Zubayr made it? But then he gave a fatwa, no. Because otherwise it's going to become a plaything for all subsequent rulers. They're going to want to do it this way, that way. Stop now, just leave it the way it is. So that's why it's the way. Yes, it's been renovated and things like that. It's been strengthened and so on. And I'll take you to a journey inside the Kaaba before you leave here. So it will give you some kind of solace that even though physically you may not go in there, but at least it will tell you what's inside, so you're not too curious. The other thing is that around the Kaaba, that is where Ismail alayhi salam and his mother Hajar alayhi salam are buried. That's the only place where you're allowed to pray on a grave. You don't know exactly where it is, but they say that there's quite a few people buried there of that time. Completing the tawaf. When you reach the black stone again, you've completed one circuit. Start the second circuit by kissing the stone. Bismillah, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Alhamd. Go around the Kaaba 6 more times, 7th. How do you end the tawaf? You end the tawaf by coming to the same spot and doing another istilam. Bismillah, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Alhamd. That's another istilam. So how many times do you end up doing istilam? 8 times. Beginning and one at the end as well. Now your tawaf is complete. Now you have to do 2 or 3 things. One is you have to drink zamzam water. It's sunnah to go and stuff yourself, they say, with your zamzam water. So stuff your sides with zamzam water and you will need it. Because it's very hot there, you would have lost a lot of, you would have become very dehydrated. And it's good to carry a bottle with you of zamzam when you're going around there. And you can fill them up there. MashaAllah, Allah reward them. They provide so much zamzam that it's not even a joke. It's so much zamzam. So keep a small bottle with you and just fill it up and then go inside. Right? Be careful of the zamzam water though, meaning there's the cooled ones, the ice cold ones, and there's the normal ones. If you go in there thinking it's very hot, let me get the ice cold ones, your throat will go very soon. Most people come back with what I call a hajj cough, alright, and a hajj throat. To avoid that, there are certain procedures which is a lot of vitamin C and multivitamins and other things that will boost your immune system. And antihistamines, if you've got a problem of allergies, as soon as you have less sleep. So that helps a lot. And avoid the cold water. Mix it. And if you can't get used to the normal tepid room temperature, which is quite hot, it's not that hot. I mean, mix it. But don't go and indulge in the cold water, otherwise you will really be suffering afterwards and you don't want to do that. So anyway, you go around, you go to Zamzam. Now before, several years ago, you could go down by the Zamzam well. It wasn't really Zamzam well, but it was down underground. They've closed that off now. It's part of the Mataf. Now you just have to go to the dispensers and you drink the water there. There are markings. If you like to find these places, there are markings in the Mataf. This is where the Zamzam well is, below this. This is where the line where the Prophet ﷺ came in from through the Banu Shayba gate. So I look for all of these things, but that's a very advanced kind of thing if you're into that history and looking for these things. They try to cover it up as much as possible. We talked about the ramal already. Only men do this ramal, not the women. Right? It's sunnah mu'akkada to do. So if you missed it, there's not going to be a penalty to do ramal. Or ittiba for that matter. If it's too crowded, just walk normally. Last four circuits, then just walk normally on those. The ittiba, this is ittiba, as you can see here. You obviously do it before you start. So if you forget, then quickly do it. And this one stays throughout. Women are not going to do this. As soon as your tawaf is over, cover your shoulder again, because it's makruh to expose your shoulders for no reason. Tawaf rulings. General tawaf rulings. Just go through them. Seven circuits anti-clockwise, eight istilams. I already mentioned Kaaba should always be on your left. You can't do tawaf outside the masjid. It has to be inside the masjid or inside the mataf. Wudu is necessary. Menstruating women, I've already mentioned that, they can't go in the masjid, so they can't do tawaf. Only the talbiyah is said aloud, nothing else. And women should avoid going into the crushing center. Also, intention of tawaf does not need to be uttered verbally. It's a mind matter. It's what you have in your mind that matters. Alright, additional. What happens when you're doing tawaf, suddenly the iqamat is called and salat time begins? What do you do then? You'll see everybody, they'll just get in line. They'll just form lines in whatever direction, just face the Kaaba. So stop there and just face the Kaaba. And start your salat. When you finish it, then just carry on from there. What happens if you were getting in line and then you're kind of pushed, then you'd have to do that part again. That's all. The other thing you have to worry about for men and women is who stands next to you. Everywhere else in the masjid, it's segregated. There are women areas and men areas. In the masjid, in Makkah as well. Just in the mataf, it's very difficult. And in the other pathways of tawaf, it's difficult. So, before they used to actually take the women out about 15-20 minutes before salat and say, go to the women's section and allow the men to continue their tawaf. But sometimes that gets very difficult. Or if you're outside in the mataf circuits, in the masjid itself. So what you do is, so that because we have a ruling which is that if you pray next to a man, for the woman it's not a problem at all who she prays next to. It's just a issue of not wanting to pray behind a man, you know, in a normal circumstance. But for men, it has a problem with their salat. It breaks your salat if you are praying next to a woman, she's on either side of you, without a barrier, and you're praying behind the same imam, the same salat. Or if you're praying behind a woman. Now, that's very difficult. It's possible. Like, I don't think I've ever had to pray next to a woman. I've been able to avoid that. Because now the women will just come, they'll just start salat. So you have to kind of move it around a bit. But it's very difficult not to pray behind a woman because that gets difficult. But you can still just try to kind of move around. There are ways you can adjust that. However, because it's such a difficult time, so many crowds, there are fatwas that consider that your salat is valid. There are fatwas that allow that, okay, fine. Another thing what might happen sometimes is that you are trying to pray salat and there's so many people, there's no place for sijda, you just found the corner and your prostration is going to be on the other person's back. It's fine. Because his is on somebody else's back. That's fine. Otherwise you have to scrunch up as much as possible and get to the ground. But just try to avoid being in that kind of a situation. The other thing in the haram is that, especially in Hajj, there's lots of places where there's no carpet. The carpets are only in the carpeted areas, the rugs. But in the area which is reserved for tawaf, there's no carpet there. So what a lot of people do is they carry a musalla with them. You buy them in the dozens outside. So just carry one that is like something you can carry over your shoulder or put in your cloth bag, that string bag, whatever you have. Because otherwise praying on the ground sometimes gets a bit uncomfortable. So it's nice. Also nice to save your space and things like that. So carry a small musalla with you if you can. Be careful, if you're close by the Kaaba, be careful to not, in ihram, to not touch the Kaaba. Why? Or the cloth, because they put a lot of good perfume on there. Right? They put a lot of good perfume on there. So if you touch it, you're going to get that on your hands. So be careful then. Keep du'as with you, or a book of du'as. But just keep a very durable book, because you'll be so sweaty and everything, and your bag, it has to be waterproof. Otherwise your pages and everything, it's in all that heat, it just gets destroyed. I think we'll have to stop here. It's salat time. We've covered a lot of the details, so inshallah after that for the hajj, it'll be quite easy to just go through. But we'll stop here inshallah for salat.